handing the presidency back to Trump was like giving ultimate power to an unstable 11-year-old.
Frankly, I think you're being a little unfair to 11-year-olds.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I am delighted to welcome my Bulwark colleague, Eric Edelman, who is the host of Shield of the Republic, another one of our podcasts. Eric is also the counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, as well as a senior fellow at the Miller Center, and also a former ambassador to Turkey and Finland, and a high-ranking Defense Department official. So he is the perfect person to talk about foreign policy today. Eric, thank you so much for being here. I want to just start with a reflection. You knew Lindsey Graham a bit, so he just passed away a couple days ago. If you wouldn't mind just giving any reflections you might have on his life. He was an important figure, if not necessarily in the end an admirable one, alas. But rest in peace, of course, and sympathies to his friends and family. But tell us your encounters with him, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Well, first, Mona, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you. I'm glad to be able to do a crossover show with you
yes.
For the Bulwark. I don't want to exaggerate my relationship with Senator Graham. I knew him a little bit. I had the opportunity to travel with him a couple of times aboard the U.S. government aircraft that Senator John McCain would take every year to the Munich Security Conference. Senator Graham was one of the three amigos, McCain, Lieberman, and Graham, and sadly now the last of those three to pass away. And they were very committed to a lot of the things I'd worked on during my time in government. Strong national defense, concern about proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, all the things that Iran that I'd spent time on.
Promoting Russia, democracy, right?
Promoting democracy very strongly, the civil war in Syria. And I, at the time thought pretty well of Senator Graham, thought that he was impressive figure. I mean, I briefed him a little bit during 2016, although briefing Lindsey on national security affairs was more like kind of listening to Lindsey rehearse his talking points for Meet the Press, and then you could kibitz and comment on them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he kind of took a different path after the 2016 election and chose to become a kind of avatar of Trumpism. In that sense, I think he's kind of emblematic of the role that ambition can play in Washington. It's kind of, it can be very disfiguring, because I think Senator Graham, and he said this to me on several occasions when I sat next to him at dinners of various sorts, either diplomatic dinners hosted by foreign embassies here in Washington or at Munich, when we would occasionally have dinner with Senator McCain. His ultimate goal was to remain relevant. And, that drove, I think, a lot of what he did. Sadly, the last thing he did was actually a kind of recurrence back to the more admirable parts of his career, which was, going to Ukraine, coming back, pushing for sanctions on Russia, defending the relationship with Ukraine. I'm sure in his own mind, he thought that whatever sort of moral compromises he was making, with Trumpism, were enabling him to, be a force for good with
yeah.
regard to Ukraine or Iran or whatever other issue he was working on. But, it's just, to me, it's a, very sorry, of course, that he passed, at what I regard now as a young age, since he's
yeah, same. Yeah. Whoa, that's so young.
Younger than I am. Just, a sad reflection on kind of Washington today in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as they said in the Monty Python skits, you know, and now for something completely different, I want to transition to something with levity because we need it in our time. So just within the last few hours, a statue appeared on the National Mall of a participation trophy. It's very amusing. It's 10 feet tall. It's a gold trophy. And here's what it says. Iran War Participation Trophy. We hereby award President Donald J. Trump this participation trophy for his enthusiastic involvement in the Iran War. While some concern themselves with military strategy, diplomacy, or measurable outcomes, President Trump demonstrated the courage to participate regardless of the final score. As the recipient of this prestigious award, President Trump joins the ranks of children everywhere who received recognition for simply showing up. So, <Ouch. laughs> hats off to whoever did that. But it now introduces the whole topic of the war in Iran. Let's take a minute and talk about OneSkin. It is summer. And the sun and the wind and salt and all of that is kind of rough for your skin, which is why you need a moisturizer. You need moisturizer all the time. And I really enjoy using OneSkin moisturizer because it is smooth. It's light. It is not overly greasy. It's awful when you put moisturizer on your face and then it's greasy and you can feel it on your skin and on your fingers. This smooths right in. It absorbs into your skin and it just gives you a nice dewy look and feel. Like if you smile, you'll notice it just feels nice and loose and comfortable. And it lasts all day. It is really, really nice. This is the OneSkin facial moisturizer that I use every morning. And I can highly recommend it. And I have tried a lot of moisturizers. Some of them are too thin. Some of them are too thick. This is the Goldilocks, just right. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code MonaCharon at oneskin.co/MonaCharon. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. So as we speak, we are recording this on Tuesday, July 14th, Bastille Day, actually. Forgot about that. For a revolution that I do not celebrate. So we've resumed shooting now in the Iran war, the truce such as it was, the shaky truce seems to be even shakier or ended. And so I thought this would be a moment to review the whole thing, how we got into the war, the aims of the war, and how it went. So in February of this year, Donald Trump joined Israel in full-on attacking Iran and demanded in the first few hours unconditional surrender. And he put on Truth Social that he wanted to have a role in choosing the next leader of Iran. Things did not go according to plan. In February, he was saying, you know, to the Iranian people, you know, help is on the way and he had said help is on the way earlier. Now in February, he's saying, take over your government. It will be yours to take. By mid-June, he was saying, well, I never cared about regime change. And let's start with the first few months of the war and what happened leading up to this memorandum of understanding. I'm going to present a statement to you, and I want to hear your reaction. Trump tried his madman theory. He tried, you know, full-on force in a very clumsy and ill-planned way, and it failed, and he was forced to sue for peace. How do you react to that statement? Too much?
No, I think that's you know, close. I would just add a few other things to it, I guess.
Please.
You know, one is that I think he thought that he could use force the way he had with Delcy Rodriguez in Venezuela, that it would be 3 or 4 days maybe of bombing that would then allow him to impose a change regime. And he may have been told some things by Bibi Netanyahu. There's this New York Times story that I'm sure you've seen about the Israelis cultivating Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, as a potential new leader of Iran.
That was a kind of head spinning side note in all this.
Particularly, and I'm going to repeat something I think I said on Shield of the Republic a couple of weeks ago, which is when that story first surfaced in the New York Times, the first thing I thought of was reports I read in government when Ahmadinejad was first elected, in which one of the economic ministers of Iran was quoted as saying, trying to talk about the economy to President Ahmadinejad is like trying to teach a donkey particle physics. You know, this was not a guy who, you know, was ever regarded as the, you know, sharpest knife in a drawer. Maybe that's what attracted the Mossad to him as a possible, you know, leader. But in any event, I think, you know, the president thought this would be easy. It turned out to be hard. The other thing I think that is relevant here is that the normal processes of government are not, you know, operating at all in this administration. I'm in the midst of reading the Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan book. And one of the big takeaways of that is that literally all the normal national security decision-making processes have been, hollowed out. The institutions are being hollowed out. There's a very good Semaphore article on the crisis in the Department of State right now that is ongoing. You know, the administration has nominated some, you know, I think almost 110 ambassadorships, although many are vacant because they haven't been confirmed, but only 9 have been career appointees, which is wildly out of whack with any previous administration, certainly the ones that you and I, you know, served in. And so, you know, there was no analysis of different branches and sequels that this, you know, use of military force might take, and what were the risks and downsides and how to mitigate the risks? None of that was done.
Can you,
Eric,
can I pause you there for just a second, since people who have not been in government may profit from learning? Just describe a few of the normal procedures that would take place in an administration that was contemplating a war.
I mean, typically what you would have is, you know, a presentation of, well, first of all, you'd have a discussion of what are the objectives.
Yes.
You know, what are we trying to accomplish here? And you would have a period of time when different agencies of the government would suggest what they think the objectives are. You'd have a process coordinated by the National Security Advisor. You'd have meetings at the assistant secretary level, then the sub-cabinet level, like the deputies meetings I would participate in when I was under Secretary of Defense or Deputy National Security Advisor to the Vice President. Then you would have a meeting of the principal officers of the government without the president present. And then you would present all this at a National Security Council meeting where the president would preside, and you'd provide alternatives to the president. The president would choose. There would be a discussion of, you know, what legal authorities were required to accomplish whatever it was.
So they would call in justice. That would be the Justice Department.
Justice Department would be speaking. You'd have the general counsel, maybe of the Department of Defense, depending on if you're talking about war plans. You would have, you know, discussion of what congressional consultations need to take place, what public affairs presentation needs to be made to get the support of the American people, et cetera, et cetera. None of these
allies.
Things were done. Yeah, allies, consultations with allies. None of these things were done before February 28th when this was launched. And the, you know, result of that, you know, unfortunately and predictably enough, is when you start to use of military force and you step off the line with that, you know, use, you don't know. It's not linear. You don't know how things are going to unfold. And typically Murphy shows up, you know, multiple times.
Yeah. And Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
And so in this particular instance, the fact that for years and years and years, we war-gamed the possibility that Iran would shut the Strait of Hormuz. And yet for the first 10 days of the war, almost nothing was done along the coast to take out the coastal batteries and installations that the Iranians had. By the way, this turns out to be a very difficult task. And also the mines. I mean, they didn't hit the mine storage facilities until about 10 days in. So, you know, this turns out to be a pretty difficult task because a lot of these coastal installations are, you know, in mountainous or hilly terrain. And as a result, they are, you know, difficult to take out. You can shut them down briefly, but the Iranians can then, you know, clear the debris and move these mobile missiles that they have back out and then strike two oil tankers like they did today from the UAE.
I picture Pete Hegseth, you know, marching into the Oval Office and, you know, crowing to Trump, you know, we destroyed their Navy. We destroyed X number of, you know, launchers. We destroyed X number of planes. And Trump saying, well, that's it. You know, we won. This is great. Not recognizing that the sheer ability to blow things up is not winning the war, right? It's forcing your adversary to give up. And they were not able, I mean, the Iranians understood right from the beginning, they were smart. You know, all we have to do is survive. And we can inflict any amount of pain on our people because we're a completely repressive, horrible regime that just in January murdered, mowed down like 30,000 protesters. So they're willing to impose as much pain as necessary on their people. But all they had to do to win against us was not lose, right? And so that's a horrible, you know, lopsided incentive structure.
You're absolutely right. The Iranians, basically, their view is that they have absorbed our best punch, which they have dreaded for a long time.
Right.
But they now realize that they have taken our best punch and that they can survive it, which makes it extremely difficult for the president, really, I think, to go back to full-scale military operations in the hope that somehow this is going to change the outcome. One of the things I've noted in the last few days, I mean, we'll see if this changes, but the raids in the last few days that we've engaged in is, I think, the sixth day today, are at a much lower level, lower number of targets than the average number of targets that we were hitting during the height of Epic Fury back in March and early April before the ceasefire was declared in April. Essentially, the Iranians win by surviving from their point of view. And, you know, you started the whole show, Mona, talking about the president calling on the Iranian people to seize their moment and to, you know, to rise up and seize their government. The reality is they've been abandoned essentially by the president. And they are now living because of the catastrophic success, you might say, of the first few days of the operation in which very senior levels of the Iranian regime were eliminated. They're now living with a regime that is, if anything, less restrained and more harder line than what we faced before February 28th. And as you pointed out in your comments earlier, with less concern for the suffering of the Iranian people, which they're perfectly willing to live with as long as the regime survives and they stay in their place of power.
Can I talk a little bit more on this topic of the best punch? Because I have the perception that because of the feckless, really idiotic way in which this war was undertaken, it has conveyed a message of American weakness that is actually like not necessarily correct. So if Trump had been a different sort of president, and if he had gotten the cooperation of allies, if he had gotten the American people behind a plan to remove this terrible regime, I'm not saying it would have been a good idea to do this. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm just saying that if he had done those things and if he had the backing of the American people, then he might have been able to force the Strait of Hormuz open because he could have sent in our very powerful ground troops and, you know, taken out those batteries and so forth on the hills and do whatever else needed doing. And maybe even had the cooperation of some allies and their militaries, not just Israel. But because of the way he did it, because he never had buy-in from the Congress or from the American people, he wouldn't dare send ground troops. And so, therefore, the Iranians are now in the position of saying, ha ha, you know, we took their best shot and we survived it. And it makes us look even weaker.
I agree with that. And in terms of regime change, I've actually written with Ray Takeh and Ruel Gerecht and others over the years about this subject for Foreign Affairs, for other publications. I don't think anybody who believed in changing the regime thought it was going to be accomplished by force of military arms. This was a regime that really has not had popular support for a very long time. I mean, this is a country where there were spontaneous pro-American demonstrations after 9/11, unlike other parts of the Middle East.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot to work with here. And this, I'll say, I think it's not totally fair to blame just the Trump administration. I think this has been a failure across multiple administrations. I would even say, including administrations in which I served, that what is required for a regime change in Iran is a patient, long-term approach of providing assistance, some of it clandestine, to Iranians to empower them. Whether it's trade unions, whether it's civic society groups. I mean, there is a pretty robust civil society in Iran, and we could have built on that. The way, for instance, President Reagan provided assistance to Solidarity in Poland in the 1980s, which laid the basis ultimately for the collapse of the communist regime in Poland in the late, even after President Reagan left office, which triggered the whole cascade of the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. You know, that's, I think, just one example of, you know, what we could have been doing over the years. It was not going to happen overnight. It was going to take time, but there was fertile ground for it. And we've, for a variety of reasons, as a government, we've never had the, you know, patience or the willingness to, you know, do what is necessary. I mean, trying to do this by force of arms, to me, never made sense.
Maybe you know the answer to this. When this administration came back in January of 2025, one of the things they did is just decimate the Voice of America and Radio Liberty and all of those soft power organs. Did they? I think I remember hearing that they eliminated the Farsi service. Is that right?
Well, they pretty much eliminated everything.
Okay, I mean, yes.
But yes, I mean, VOA, USAID. I mean, there were a lot of different, you know, tools we could have been using to provide more, you know, assistance. But yes, they were.
And
all
one of
disabled.
The things that's so hard for the domestic opposition in Iran, which, as you say, is robust, but they're up against an unbelievably brutal regime, but they have trouble communicating with one another because of the regime's tendency to shut down the internet, and if you can't communicate, then you can't coordinate, and so on. And there are ways that we could get, you know, like satellite communication stuff in there, or I don't know what all the details
Starlink,
would be.
Yeah.
Starlink. So anyway, those would be okay. So let's talk, though, about the effect that this has on our allies. So let's first talk about the reaction of the Gulf states, who, you know, were sort of victims of this war, and they're kind of left out in the cold. I mean, after they took incoming from the Iranians and disrupted their economies and all the rest of it. You know, we just negotiated over their heads and they had no say. So how is that going to affect our relationship with that group of allies?
I think for the Gulf states, there's a kind of set of contradictory impulses that this has set off. On the one hand, it's heightened a lot of their fears of the Iranian regime, which already were pre-existing. And the fact that the Iranians had no compunctions about attacking their territory once this kicked off, even though they were not necessarily allowing the U.S. to use the bases on their territory for strikes on Iran, obviously reinforces, you know, their fear and loathing, you know, of the Iranians. On the other hand, I think they regard the United States now as a very unpredictable, unreliable actor, because, as you say, we've negotiated over their heads about this. The president just made this announcement that we are now going to charge, you know, a 20% toll on all goods transferred through the Persian Gulf. And already the foreign minister of Iran, Araghchi, has, you know, posted a tweet saying, you know, we agree actually with the president that those who guarantee the security of the Gulf should get paid for it, but we're going to be much more fair. 20% highway robbery. We're going to be much more fair in what we charge.
It's this unbelievable.
This is just what the Gulf states, I think, were afraid of, because they think Trump is blustering, that he's going to lose interest in all this ultimately and walk away. But he'll have set the predicate for the Iranians to say, we're charging tolls because we're in control of the strait.
We said when the Iranians threatened to charge tolls that this violates international law. You can't do that.
Well, and this is a traditional U.S. position on freedom of navigation of these kinds of waters through straits, not just, you know, the Strait of Hormuz, but, you know, there's the Strait of Malacca. There are various other straits that are very important to global commerce. And, you know, that's a principled position we've had for years, which just in the, you know, blink of a Truth Social post has been discarded.
Oh, it's astounding. So that's one set of allies. Another set of allies that Trump treated badly here are the Europeans. So NATO, can you talk about that? I mean, of course, he trashes NATO on a regular basis, but in this case, you know, he blamed them for not coming in to help, having not consulted with them at all beforehand. Anyway, take it away.
Well, so, I mean, look, on the one hand, you know, at least at the outset of the war, a number of NATO allies actually said, look, it would be good if we could get rid of this regime. But as you say, they weren't consulted about this. He entered the war, I think, thinking he didn't need them. But ultimately, he discovered that he did. I mean, among other things, going back to my point about not planning for the control of the Strait of Hormuz being contested by the Iranians, all of our minesweeping capability was not in the theater at the time. So the minesweepers that we had in the Persian Gulf, which were wooden-hulled ships that could go in and do this, were actually slated for retirement, had been returned to the United States in December.
Did you say wooden hull?
Yeah, they were wooden hulled ships because that way they are not, you know,
magnetic.
Not magnetic. They don't get blown up by magnetic mines.
Okay.
They were being retired. Those are, I think, the Avenger class ships. The littoral combat ships that have the mine sweeping capabilities that are resident in the U.S. Navy. And there's a whole other story there about the degree to which the U.S. Navy does not like to do minesweeping. But those littoral combat ships with the mine countermeasure suites that do exist in the Navy were in the Indo-Pacific, you know, several thousand miles away. Now, as it turns out, our NATO allies have quite a bit of, you know, minesweeping capability. And it would have been useful, you know, to have that at hand. But understandably, you know, in a battle space that the United States Navy is very chary about introducing its combatants into for fear that one of them will be knocked out by a cruise missile, the way Her Majesty's ship Sheffield was during the Falklands War by the Argentinians, that, you know, our allies don't want to, you know, tread into those waters until there is some kind of peace agreement. So the president's fulminations, you know, against our NATO allies for not helping, you know, in some sense, I mean, there's a level at which it's understandable, but it's also, there's a level at which it's hard to sympathize with, because, you know, he's like the, you know, kid who shoots his parents and then goes, throws himself on the mercy of the court and says, you know, have mercy on me, Your Honor, I'm a poor orphan.
So handing the presidency back to Trump was like giving ultimate power to an unstable 11-year-old. You know, he gloats about, I have command over the greatest military in the world, you know, refusing to take any advice from anyone about the dangers of war, about how things can go wrong, about, yes, we have the greatest military on the planet, but even the greatest military can't do everything. And we still need allies, and you still need planners, and you still need Congress, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, so having been heedless and rushing into this, and then things are going badly. Why? Because the Iranians say, fine, you know, we don't care if our people suffer. We're going to just wait you out. And so now he's frustrated. Things haven't gone the way he wanted. And speaking of fulminating, he starts issuing these crazy, you know, threats saying, I'm going to destroy Iranian civilization, you know, tomorrow, unless you bastards submit. And, you know, that too has caused him to be a laughingstock. I mean, the Iranians were posting hilarious memes. The Iranians were funny online. I never thought I'd live to see that. Mocking his obvious empty threats.
Yeah, I mean, I think these threats are, they're ill-considered for a variety of reasons. I mean, one, if he were to actually carry out some of these threats, they would essentially be war crimes.
Absolutely.
Point two, it's pretty clear, and it's been clear to the Iranians, that he's not going to carry through on a lot of these threats. And those kinds of empty threats are, I think, very dangerous. I mean, he just yesterday was on the UU at show saying, we're going to take out Pickaxe Mountain, you know, and you know, let them know they were coming through. We're going to knock down Pickaxe Mountain. Pickaxe Mountain is one of the nuclear sites that has not yet been hit, in part because it's not clear that it's actually ever been operational or there's any actual threatening you know, material in it that needs to be taken out, but also be very difficult military objective because it is literally built into a mountain. But you know, if you intended to do that, why would you give the Iranians notification that you were coming? I mean, it's just, so all of this is just betrays, you know, I mean, frankly, I think you're being a little unfair to 11-year-olds, but it clearly betrays
unstable, an unstable 11-year-old.
I am. Okay. I'm not sure you're being fair to unstable 11-year-olds, but still, you know, this is not the way the, you know, leader of the free world ought to conduct himself. That's all I would say.
Okay. Another ally. Now, Israel has walked itself into an awful situation with its failure of public diplomacy, in my opinion. And with its too tight alliance with Trump, that is Netanyahu's too tight alliance with Trump. But in terms of betrayal, they too have an argument that they've been utterly betrayed by Trump because, you know, first he goes in with them and they're in this together and we're going to, and then suddenly he flips and now J.D. Vance is telling Israel that they better shut up and stop their war in Lebanon, which is a defensive war, but anyway, because we're your only friend left and we don't like you very much. You know? So the Israelis are really, boy, if there's ever a lesson, in not trusting Trump, they I hopefully have learned it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu made a terrible mistake, you know, sort of wrapping himself up with Trump. And
completely.
And the look, every Israeli prime minister has to work closely with whoever the president of the United States is. Prime Minister Netanyahu had some pretty unpleasant experiences with a lot of the folks around President Obama and with President Obama. I get that. But, you know, Israel's strength for
a long time. Let me just say, because we're about to talk about the JCPOA, which actually doesn't look so bad compared to the MOU.
Where we are
so
now.
I'm going to get to that. But let me just say that to just underline what you said, because Netanyahu is obnoxious. There's no question about it. And he's,
right.
I think he's a really sinister figure at this point. But
agreed.
It is true that Obama really dissed him. I mean,
yeah.
Like he left him. He left the White House. He had been Netanyahu had been invited to stay for dinner. And Obama just got annoyed at him and walked out, left him there.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the problem here is Israel's strength has been it's had bipartisan support.
Yeah.
And you have to work with one president at a time. We only have one president. You know, I get that, you know, as you say, he was annoyed with Obama. Joe Biden actually, you know, uncharacteristically really stood by Israel. I mean, I shouldn't say uncharacteristically,
very much so.
But he, I mean, you know, because Biden has always been, I think, a strong supporter of Israel, but he really stood by in the post, you know, October 7th period in a way that I don't think anybody would have predicted, even as there were lots of questions about what the Israelis were doing. Was it scratchy? Yes, of course, because it's always kind of a scratchy relationship when you're engaged in that kind of military activity. I don't think Bibi helped himself by never actually defining what the end state was in Gaza.
Exactly.
And never, really kind of making his peace with the fact that there had to be some kind of humanitarian assistance going to the Gazans while this was all going on.
Right.
All
and of never this was, clarifying that our war, that his war was against Hamas, not against the Palestinian people, which
right.
they should have been saying over and over again, and they failed to do.
Yeah, no, all of that was terribly mishandled, but the result of which I think is now potentially a catastrophe for Israel, which is if you look at the polling, support for Israel among Democrats has cratered.
Yep.
And it is in the Republican Party, you know, it's it's our generation that still has the residual kind of connection to Israel. But when you look at younger Republican-oriented voters, not at all the case.
Yeah.
And so down the road, the potential here is for really a catastrophic loss of support from the United States as time goes on. And so I think the wages of this are going to be paid, you know, down the line.
I think Israel has done many, many things wrong. And certainly they would acknowledge they have an extremism problem of their own with their religious extremists. On the other hand, some of the rhetoric and some of the accusations that have now been become conventional wisdom, such as that Israel has committed genocide,
yep.
is way over the top. That is just
yep.
not true.
Right.
And we need to push back on that. It is, because in our era, you know, nuance has been lost. You know, you can say that something is ill-advised. You can say that there has been, you know, bad judgment, you know, cruel behavior, whatever. But genocide is a separate thing.
It's interesting because, Elliot and I were talking about this last week on Shield of the Republic. We were talking about Rahm Emanuel's speech in Israel and the criticism, et cetera. You know, one of the things that really struck me is that when you look at what's happening in the Democratic Party, I mean, so we were just talking about Biden having stood by Israel. All the people who are involved in that, Jake Sullivan, John Feiner, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, are now being pilloried by the progressive left inside the Democratic Party. They're being kind of read out of the party in some cases which is crazy. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the platform of the Democratic Socialists of America, we had Bill Galston on, a former panelist on, mm-hmm. on Beg to Differ. And, you know, Bill was making the point that this is not Michael Harrington's, you know, social democratic, democratic socialist movement. This is something far more radical. And if you look at their platform, the disproportion in regard to Israel, I mean, you read their platform, you would think Israel is the only problem in the world and the only place where people are dying.
Yeah.
You would not know that, you know, the government of North Korea has, you know, murdered millions of its citizens, or that the Iranians Sudan. murdered 30,000 people, or that there's, you know, a huge problem in Sudan or the Democratic Republic of Congo. I mean, it's literally all Israel, as if that is the be all and end all of evil in the world. It's just so disproportionate and out of whack. And I worry, honestly, that, you know, the president's fulminating about the Democrats being communists, and this is clearly going to be a leitmotif of Republican campaigning, both in the midterms and in the 2028 election. The Democratic Party I grew up in, because I started life as a you know, John F. Kennedy kind of Democrat, was a party that knew it had to exclude communists from its movement, you know, under the leadership of Scoop Jackson, Hubert Humphrey, other Cold War liberals. Communists were kicked out of trade unions. They were excluded from the Democratic Party. Henry Alt Wallace had to run his campaign that was actually covertly supported by the Communist Party of the United States as a third party candidate. He couldn't run as a Democrat, even though he'd been Franklin Roosevelt's vice president. You know, having watched the GOP, you know, get completely consumed by the MAGA movement to the point where it is now just a cult, you know, as our publisher Sarah Longwell likes to say, you know, the Republican Party has become a authoritarian threat to democracy, and the Democratic Party is very bad at politics. Well, we're going to really be cooked if we end up having two parties that are authoritarian threats to democracy. And that's what Democrats are looking at unless they get this under control.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I can anticipate some of the comments from our listeners. So I just want to make a couple of quick points. So people say, you know, socialism, what's wrong with socialism? Isn't that what Denmark has? Isn't that what Sweden has? And what's so bad about it? And so I would just say that's not what we're talking about. Okay, with defining terms a little bit. So first of all, those countries are not socialists. They have thriving private sectors. They simply have a bigger safety net than we do. And they finance that by high taxes on the middle class. Now, we could do that, but it would require raising taxes on the middle class. And that's a hard thing to do. So I'm just saying so the word socialist is slippery, because the communists always call themselves socialists, right? It's always, you know, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, et cetera. And so it's very important to distinguish between the two. You can have, there are socialist parties in Europe that are Democrats, small d Democrats, and that abide by election results and that, you know, believe in free speech and individual liberty and all of that. That's very different from the communist model. I mean, that's a second nature to you and me because we lived through the Cold War. But for younger people, these distinctions may not be so obvious.
I agree.
And I just would point out that if you go to the Democratic Socialists of America websites, you will find pictures of Mao, pictures of Lenin. I mean, that's not Scandinavian socialism. That is communism. And that is something that is going to, first of all, it's bad in and of itself. It's evil. It's responsible for 100 million deaths in the 20th century.
And it's totally failed everywhere it's been implemented.
It's totally failed everywhere it's been tried. And it is perfect fodder for Republicans who are so weak right now. But if they can wave that bloody shirt and say, see, this is what the Democrats are, it's such an own goal by the Democrats.
Agreed.
It just is really worrying.
This is the point I was trying to make by mentioning that it's not Michael Harrington's, you know, social democratic movement that he founded. I mean, he was one of the founders of DSA back, I think, in the 70s or early 80s. And, you know, he was a very interesting and admirable character in a lot of ways. He, you know, wrote The Other America in the early 60s. It drew attention to the fact of poverty in the midst of plenty in the United States. But he was always very much a small D Democrat, and not, a Democratic centralist, you know, in believing in a Leninist vanguard party, which is pretty much what DSA is. So it's a vanguard party that's trying to, kind of like a vampire, you know, suck all the blood out of the Democratic Party, use it for ballot access, and then leave it for dead later.
And there's one more point to make about that, which is, you know, it's one thing to run these kinds of candidates in solid blue districts. But first of all, then that gives an opportunity for the Republicans to make campaign ads saying that this represents the whole the whole Democratic Party. But then if they attempt to run these kinds of candidates in swing states, they are losing the opportunity to win elections. So, because those candidates will not do well in other parts of America. Okay. So, one more aspect of all of this that I would like to talk about, because I promised we were going to compare the JCPOA, which I know you opposed and you testified against, and this memorandum of understanding. Now, the MOU is just a preliminary document. It isn't an agreement, really. It was just a truce agreement. But in terms of what Trump claimed he was trying to achieve, and although that was a bit nonspecific, but he did say certain things. And compared to the criticism that he has always made about what a disaster the JCPOA was, I wonder if you could evaluate the difference between those two things. I mean, the JCPOA, just for one example, was a nuclear deal. The idea was to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It did at least require international inspectors. Right. The MOU required only that Iran reiterated its commitment that it would never build a nuclear weapon.
Which is also in the JCPOA, by the way.
Which is also in the JCPOA, and which is just words.
So, look, you're right. I did criticize the JCPOA. I testified against it in the Senate Armed Services Committee in August of 2015. I think it was a flawed, deeply flawed agreement, not least of the reasons being that the 8, 10, and 15-year limits that marked the agreement would all be expiring now. I mean, by 2030, they would all be gone. And President Obama himself admitted at the time that when the final 15-year limits on enrichment ran out in 2030, which is, you know, less than 4 years away, Iran would have the capability, because they had, you know, it preserved an industrial scale enrichment capability for Iran, that they would be, you know, potentially weeks away from having enough fissile material to make a nuclear weapon. He admitted that himself at the time. So, you know, that's that. The MOU, I mean, the main difference between the MOU and the JCPOA, the JCPOA, for all its flaws, was negotiated by a team of professionals who knew what they were doing and knew that they were making some compromises with what they would have liked to have had as an agreement. But the MOU was negotiated by amateurs who don't understand any of these issues. And one reason why the ceasefire has broken down is that the language that they negotiated, particularly on the control of the Strait of Hormuz, they failed to appreciate would be seen by Iran as essentially validating Iran's control. And so bad diplomacy. We talked earlier about the hollowing out of the State Department, the lack of professional diplomats. This is what happens when you get amateurs doing this. You get a, you know, poorly drafted agreement open to multiple interpretations and not capable of accomplishing what you want to accomplish, which is, in this instance, to bring an end to the conflict and set the stage for longer negotiation that will deal with all the various elements of the Iran problem, notably which the JCPOA did not, you know, deal with. I mean, so the JCPOA, as you rightly pointed out, was a nuclear agreement, didn't do anything about Iran's support for proxies around the region, destabilizing the Middle East, or its very large-scale ballistic missile program. And it's worth noting that no country has, amassed the number of both, medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles that Iran has, and short range, that doesn't have a nuclear weapon. So, you know, what was the point of all that, you know, at some level? Though I opposed the JCPOA, I did not approve of the manner in which the president withdrew from it in his first term, in part because I think that required a much more intense, again, consultation with allies. I mean, there were allies who recognized that the JCPOA had not succeeded in some of what it had set out to do, which was to create the circumstances in which you could have coexistence between Iran and notably the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf states, as President Obama suggested it would do. I think there were a lot of Europeans who recognized Iran continued to be a problem, and maybe you needed, you know, a longer, stronger agreement in order to deal with the problem. He chose to just simply, you know, withdraw. And ultimately, that opened the door to the Iranians continuing to enrich uranium, to go beyond the limits. They stayed within the limits of the JCPOA for a while and then began to exceed them. I do think the Biden administration bears a little bit of onus here, too, in the sense that they insisted that there was no military solution to this problem, that there was only a diplomatic solution to the problem. But when diplomacy clearly was running out of airspace and altitude, I mean, essentially the Iranians were refusing to really make any kind of agreement with the Biden team. The Biden team kept saying, you know, time for diplomacy is not endless. We, you know, have to do something, but there's no military option. So they painted themselves really into a very bad corner. I will say, I did not have a problem with what the president did in May last year with Operation Midnight Hammer. I mean, I thought that was an appropriate use of U.S. military power. It was limited in scope. It accomplished, if not the entire objective, bulk of the objective, in disabling the nuclear program. It did mean that we might have to, you know, at some point go back and revisit some of those nuclear targets, but I don't think it required what got unleashed on February 28th, obviously.
So this war is not yet over, but so do you think that Iran post-war, bearing in mind that it has suffered damage, no question, but do you think that Iran is weakened or strengthened or neither post-war?
I think it's a little early for us to tell the, you know, what the answer to that question is. Iran, the Iranian government still faces massive problems. So it you know, before the war started, there was a massive water problem in Iran. There's a food distribution problem that they have. There's an electricity distribution problem that they have. The economy has been stagnant for years. One of the things that triggered the uprising in December and January was the collapse of the rial, the Iranian currency. Given all the sanctions, Iran is the most sanctioned country in the world. So they've got lots of problems to manage. I think that in some ways what's happened is the current conflict has given them a little bit of a new lease on life, in part because until people can come out, there's no way for them to contest the regime. But the regime's also shown itself to be willing to kill as many people as it takes to, you know, to keep in power. And that has a chilling effect as well. So I think it's going to take some time, you know, to tell. I mean, sometimes these things don't happen right away. So just a couple of examples. You know, the war in Kosovo ended very unsatisfactorily from Milosevic's point of view in Serbia, thanks to the combined efforts of the United States and the European Union. And it took about a year or more before popular revolt brought him down. It didn't happen immediately. Similarly, it took a long time, you know, for the Assad regime to collapse. People thought it was going to collapse when the civil war broke out. You know, it ultimately collapsed when both its Russian and Iranian outside sponsors were preoccupied with matters closer to home, which is ultimately what led to the collapse of the Assad regime in December of 2024. So it may take some time for us to actually tell. I mean, you know, my preference right now would be for us to start thinking about how to bring down the regime and to start investing in the kinds of things we talked about earlier, aid to trade unions or aid to, you know, democracy, pro-democracy groups, helping teach people how to communicate, giving them communications equipment like Starlink. All the things that it you know, will take in order to create a popular uprising against the regime when it is reached the point that it can't get the instruments of repression to fire on people anymore.
In Syria, the opposition had weapons, and that was critical. The opposition in Iran has no weapons.
Right.
What about that?
Look, if there's anything our intelligence community knows how to do, it's how to run guns. And I don't know that it's the right point yet, because you obviously you need to have a level of organization. You need to have people who are really ready to take up arms, you know. And I don't know that we're at that point yet, but certainly that has got to be part of a regime change strategy.
Okay, a question about China. How do you think all of this looks in Beijing? The whole war, the way it's gone, how does this affect Taiwan, if at all? Everybody's calculations.
For the Chinese, first of all, they've shown themselves to be quite resilient against the disruption of the energy economy, which people, you know, have thought they were very concerned about for a long time. Obviously, they were able to buffer the supply disruption and the price effect for quite some time with the very large reserves they had built up. Now, whether they can, you know, I don't know they can do that ad infinitum, but it certainly has paid off. You know, there's a mix of things they're probably taking from this. I think they're probably studying it very closely, as they study all of our military campaigns very closely. I think they're probably going to be pretty impressed by a lot of what we did with air power, the suppression of enemy air defenses, the, you know, a lot of Russian kit that we disabled very, you know, very easily, since a lot of their stuff is essentially reverse engineered from Russian, you know, equipment. So I'm sure they're studying it, and I think they're probably looking at, they may be also, you know, taking the lesson that, you know, amphibious operation across 90 miles of open ocean that nobody has tried in a very long time and very rarely successful. Maybe we want to think twice before we launch something like that. I mean, I think there are probably a variety of lessons they may take from this, and I'm not sure. Again, I think it may be a little early to judge exactly what they're taking.
One optimistic take might be that if you look at Ukraine and Iran, maybe a lesson there is a huge power, bigger, stronger, more militarily strong, doesn't necessarily prevail over another, an adversary that is tough and willing to, you know, fight and maintain its defenses.
Yes, and I hope Taiwan actually is taking some notes.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah,
They need to be doing some lesson learning as well.
Right, exactly. Okay, one last big question, then I will let you go. So the United States still has, despite our horrible leadership, still has enormous strength. I mean, the strength of our economy is like a wonder of the world. It really is. I mean, even when we have horrible leadership, even when, you know, we make mistakes, it's just an amazing engine of prosperity. And that economy has allowed us to build this huge military. A lot, I believe that a lot of what we did with that military in the post-World War II era, even though we made our mistakes and made bad decisions, most of what we did was to preserve international peace and stability. Do you think we're now living through the end of that era? Is it going to be that the U.S. is no longer going to be the leader in protecting global shipping and trade and commerce and peace and protecting smaller nations against aggression? Do you think that's over or not?
You know, there's a famous, somewhat apocryphal story about Henry Kissinger and Zhou Enlai, who he asked him about the French Revolution, and and Zhou says it's too early to tell. But of course, the punchline of that joke is that Zhou was talking about the French Student Revolution of 1969.
But anyway, right? Yes,
I do think it may be a little too early to tell. Look, this administration has done grievous damage to the global order that the United States built and sustained since 1945. And some people who have written very effectively and studied that, like my friend Bob Kagan, you know, are saying that it's done. We put a fork in it. There's not much we can do to bring it back. That might be right. I don't know. You know, certainly U.S. primacy around the world is now going to be contested much more than it's already been under contest since the Great Recession of 2008-9. Our primacy has been contested. It hasn't been uncontested as it was between 1989 and 2009 for about 20 years. We still, as you say, have an economy that's the marvel of the world. We lead the world in innovation. The race for AI is going to, you know, be a big factor in, you know, how that story comes out. We have a fantastic military establishment. As you said, it can't do everything, but it can do a lot. We need to, I think, recognize the scale of the challenge we're facing, which is enormous, much bigger than anything we faced during the Cold War, and, you know, going back rivals what we did in World War II when we faced an axis of adversaries, Germany, Japan, Italy. This is in some ways even more daunting between Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, this axis of adversaries that we're facing. That means we're going to have to spend more on defense. I'm a little despairing of the current, you know, debate about this, because the way the administration wants to go about this, you know, strikes me as typically enough kind of half-assed, trying to shove this big chunk of money into the Department of Defense through the, you know, reconciliation process, which I'm not sure the department can absorb well, which will likely lead to, you know, stories of waste, fraud, and abuse in the Pentagon. It'll make it harder to sustain. What we need is a ramp up to a level of funding that's roughly 5% of GDP, which is below what we spent in the Cold War, but because we have a much larger economy, probably sufficient to meet our needs, but it then needs to be sustained. You know, we can't have the kind of sine curve, you know, up and down funding that we've typically had, you know, for most of our post-war history. So I'm, you know, I try to still be an optimist, but it's getting harder every day given the damage that's being inflicted.
All right. I wish we could end on a happier note. I guess people, if they want to smile, will have to go look at the participation trophy. but Eric, thank you so much for joining me and offering your tremendous wisdom on these subjects. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's always great to be with you, Mona.